Well, I have asked Nabila to treat us like a small informal group rather than a formal lecture, so I'll have her do that. She has come with her brother and sister as well. Are they going to be with us, or did they run? They ran. Okay. All right. Well, it was a delight to meet them. So welcome, everybody. And in today's colloquium, we're celebrating the writing program's 10th anniversary, and we're doing so by welcoming Nabila Hijazi. So we're happy to have you. I first met Nabila on JMU campus at the Midwestern Writing Centers Association conference in April 2015, and she presented on a project she was heading up, a website for cultural and linguistic awareness, a highly useful site. And I believe it says on that site that it recognizes that students from each national group share a set of writing difficulties which are closely related to the linguistic and cultural background. If I could just say here, share a set of writing in English difficulties. And we have that site on our writing program website, and it's very helpful. So you can go to that site, and among other things, you can click on a language, and that language will take you into, as a hyperlink, to tell you what sorts of things Arabic speakers, for example, what values they have about writing and how that differs from English and so forth. It's very helpful. So let me just give an introduction here to Nabila. In 2004, 13 years ago, Nabila joined the University of Maryland Writing Center as an undergraduate tutor and conducted research about the role of the non-native tutor in the Writing Center. In 2006, she advanced to pursue her master's degree in English with a concentration in rhetoric and composition, and to teach for the English department. She's taught classes in academic writing, writing center theory and practice, and grammar. For her master's capstone project titled Global Issues Hindering Effective ESL Writing and Composition Teaching, Culture and Identity and Conflict Across Different Rhetorical Conventions, she won first place in Graduate Research Interaction Day under the category Exploring Identities and Their Expressions. She worked as an assistant director at the Undergraduate Writing Center. Before leaving her position, she created resources to train undergrad tutors to work with ESL students. Currently, she's working as a writing fellow for the Graduate Writing Center. She's also a PhD candidate in rhetoric and composition and is finishing her prospectus for her dissertation, in which she will investigate the literacy practices of adult refugee learners. She will identify the educational strategies for teaching these learners and provide a teaching resource for other teachers based on her project's findings. Her title today is Preparation for the Linguistics and Cultural Diversity Through Intercultural Communication. And I was going to say that we'll have time for Q&A after, but I think we'll just do that throughout as this is informal. Welcome, Nabila.
I will go through the PowerPoint if you don't mind. And okay. Usually I speak fast, I go fast. So if you have any question, please stop me. Okay. First, I'm going to go over the increase in the percentage of international students, ESL students, on different campuses in the US before I go into the different sections of the PowerPoint. So as international immigrant student enrollments continue to grow at both secondary institutions across the United States, the percentage of students who speak and write in English as a second or third language is steadily increasing in all college campuses across the U.S. I know that's the case for you, and also that's the case for us, University of Maryland, College Park. Data from the Institute of International Education show that the number of international students at U.S. campuses has increased by 72% since 2000. A large number of these ESL students feel challenged with writing, and we writing faculty may struggle to support and work with these students. Therefore, it's prudent to examine the literature to explore the factors that drive success in teaching writing to ESL students. Ultimately, I decided to examine the rhetorical impetuses and cultural aspects that inform ESL students' communication and writing styles. Okay. So in what follows, I will explain what intercultural communication and culture mean. I will discuss how intercultural communication theories can shed light on teaching ESL students whose cultures play a major role in the ways they write and communicate by discussing factors that can make communication problematic and strategies to achieve mutual understanding. Then I will compare two cultures, American and Arab culture. And honestly, I chose Arab culture because I'm originally from Syria. I speak Arabic. And also because I'm going forward to work with refugees who come from Arab countries, especially Syria. In terms of communication and persuasion, and show how understanding the differences between cultural communication patterns can help teachers recognize and understand the style and the moves ESL students make. Afterwards, I will show a writing sample by an ESL Arab student, and we will end with a discussion of few scenarios and possible responses. However, I want to emphasize that I am not an expert in intercultural communication, and I do not have the magic answers to all problems. All I want to do is just to raise awareness about the issue, and hopefully we can benefit from the discussion. Okay. So what is intercultural communication? So intercultural communication is communication between members of two or more social cultural groups or between people of different mother tongues. It is one in which the cultural distance between the participants is significant enough to have an effect on the interaction and communication between the participants. The effect is noticeable to at least one of the parties. Spencer OT ETL 2011 defined intercultural communication as, quote, the process by which communicative intentions are produced and interpreted or misinterpreted, and on the ways in which meanings are negotiated and constructed, exploring the ways in which contextual and situational factors impact these processes, including cultural ones, end quote. So in order to achieve constructive communication without misunderstanding or breakdowns, education on cultural similarities and differences can help. However, in order to understand intercultural communication, it's important to know the definition of culture. Okay. So what is culture? Okay. So despite numerous efforts to adequately define culture, there isn't an agreement among anthropologists regarding its nature or its definition. However, based on different viewpoints of what culture is, Spencer, Otey, and Franklin, 2009, draw attention to a number of important characteristics of culture. Okay, first, culture is manifested through different types of regularities. Culture is associated with the social groups, but no two individuals within a group share the same cultural characteristics. Three, culture affects people's behavior and interpretation of behavior, and culture is acquired and or constructed through interactions with them. So members of the same types of cultural groups share a larger range of types of regularities than others. People of the same culture incorporate the regularities they experience over time in and across given contexts. However, their actual practices emerge from a dynamic interaction of these regularities with improvisation. So in fact, culture emerges when patterns start to develop or when they are consciously created through espoused values. The regularities of the culture are manifested in numerous but interrelated ways, and culture is associated with innumerable types of social groups that can vary in size and complexity, ranging from religion to professional groups. So people are simultaneously members of different cultural groups. Okay. However, when deciding or when describing cultural groups according to Spencer, Otey, and Franklin, 2009, we need to be aware of three dangers. The risk of overgeneralization, and that's one of the major warnings that I keep reminding myself, and even on the website itself, I try to emphasize that. So now I'm not trying to overgeneralize, but at least if we know the characteristics, it's at least easier for us to work with certain group of students. Second, inappropriate stereotyping with incorrect labeling, characterization, and prejudice. And three, excessive essentialism and reductionism, assuming essential properties being attached to a group. With these definitions in mind, I want to focus on ways to achieve understanding in intercultural discourse. Building mutual understanding in intercultural communication occurrences between members of two different social groups is a challenging process. Therefore, it's necessary to focus on the factors that make communication problematic. Spencer OTETL 2011 argue that the less the participants have in common, linguistically, culturally, and personally, the greater expected difficulty in achieving mutual understanding, and hence the more noticeable the occurrence of misunderstanding in intercultural communication. Therefore, many studies have focused on the factors that can make communication problematic. So according to Spencer OTETL 2011, these factors include linguistic code factors, high context versus low context communication style, power dynamics, and pragma linguistic failure. I'm going to go over like each one by one. So the first one is linguistic code factors. Linguistic code factors include mispronunciation or mishearing of a lexical item, unfamiliarity with the lexical item, and structural complexity and ellipses. However, even when there are no language code problems, achieving understanding can still be extremely difficult. The second one is, which is like the one I found very helpful and I got so much information from, is high context and low context communication styles. What each one means, high context communication includes communication patterns of indirect verbal mode, including self-humbling talk and nonverbal subtleties where the listener assumes the responsibility to infer the heading or the contextual meaning of the message. Reading also between the lines. The information is either in the physical context or the internalized in the coded transmitted part of the message. The problem for speakers from high-context speech communities in developing competence in the signaling cues associated with the low-context culture. And after I go over this, I'm going to go compare two cultures. One is high context and low, one is low context, and like discuss how the differences can affect communication, even writing. Low context communication includes communication patterns of direct verbal mode, including straight talk and sender-oriented values, where the speaker assumes the responsibility to communicate clearly. The mass of information is vested in the explicit code. And usually the American culture is known to be as low context in terms of communication. Okay. Then I'm going to go to power dynamics. What I mean by power dynamics, subordinates cannot question those in authority, and that's usually with cultures that are that have high context. So high power dynamics, cultures may severely limit interactions. Social theory, particularly in the work of Foucault and Bourdieu, engages in the power relations and the context between interaction and power. Roberts, 1996, argues that power is restricted in modern society not by force but by discourse. The dominant discourses of society use ideology to construct and maintain power, but also make and conceal from people the way in which such ideology works, preventing open communication and understanding and leading to domination. Okay, and usually, I do not want to generalize, but usually, cultures in the East, the Middle East or East, they use the power dynamics, and there's usually students who come from that cultures, they do not question those who are in place of authority. Okay. Then we have pragma linguistic failure, which means mismatches that may occur between the speaker's intended meaning and the hearer's constructed meaning concerning the linguistic resources available and conventionally used for conveying a given pragmatic meaning in a given context. Okay. However, according to Spencer Otey and Franklin 2009, the strategies that are needed to achieve mutual understanding in intercultural communication include negotiating a common understanding of terms, corrective and preventive strategies, and linguistic accommodations and language adjustment. And I'm going to go over each one by one. Okay. So negotiating a common understanding of terms. Since people of different cultures understand the world differently, they need to make a deliberate effort trying to come to terms with each other's meanings. So there has to be some kind of reach out to each other, trying to understand each other and make the communication easier. Okay. And corrective and preventive strategies include clarification requests, confirmation requests, and self reformation by which speakers clearly structure their ideas. Examples include creating an environment in which it's clear that students can ask for clarification, or creating time and methods for things to be clarified, putting things in writing, and offering examples of what to expect. And usually that happens in the classroom when we ask the students or give them enough time or encourage them to ask, because most of the time students are silent. They do not want to question the teacher, even if they do not understand something. So by trying to allow for this kind of environment, it would be easier for the students to express their concerns.
I know that does take time, because I'm in a power position.
Yes. Yes.
About an understanding of words, and I can tell that we're still not understanding each other.
Yes.
But I found also that if I take time, it doesn't always help, but it's a key factor.
Yes.
It's hard to remember.
And sometimes even like over time, and you can see the students kind of like progress or growth from the beginning until the end of the semester. Yeah. Even like sometimes for me, what I do, I keep emphasizing, and usually I teach international students, I emphasize that all of us have an accent, including me, so that shouldn't be a barrier for us to communicate. So if you have any issue, please like voice it, and yeah, we can at least. And I'm willing to like work with you even outside of class time. Yeah. Then we have linguistic accommodation and language adjustment, which means adjusting one's use of language to proficiency level of the recipients. And I usually find it with my freshman students, because we, English 101 in University of Maryland is rhetoric-based, and we use so much of rhetorical theory, and students find it very difficult to understand, especially students who come from different countries. So I have to like break down the terms and make them understand or help them understand what the terms mean. And as you said, it takes more time and even takes more effort from me and even from like the whole class. Okay. So any delayed and unsolved misunderstandings can lead to dissatisfaction and potential failure. Therefore, it's essential to address many potential misunderstandings at any early stage to prevent serious consequences. And to show how cultures differ, I will give an example by comparing two cultures, Arab and American cultures, in terms of communication patterns and persuasion. So the next slide is going to be about communication patterns. Then I'm going to go to discuss how persuasion is used in writing. So the first one is about communication patterns and the difference between the two cultures. So as you can see, the first one is high context and low context. So the difference between high context and low context cultures depend on how much meaning is found in the context versus in the code. So low context cultures, such as the American culture, tend to place meaning in the language code and very little meaning in the context. Therefore, communication tends to be specific, explicit, and analytical. However, in high context cultures, such as the Arab culture, meaning is embedded in the context, placing the responsibility on the listener to recognize the contextual cues in order to understand the meaning, the message. Arabs, being raised in high-context system, expect more from their listeners. They expect them to figure out the information. For Arabs, being too explicit or specific undermines the listener's intellectual skills. And I had this issue when I came to this country. It did not make sense to me. How can I tell my reader from the beginning what I'm going to say? So it's like I'm undermining their intellectual ability. But now, of course, I had to change because that's the... And what makes it even interesting is knowing my audience allows me to know how to structure my message or even my essay. So for Arabs, being too explicit or specific undermines the listener's intellectual skills. Thus, he or she will talk around the point, putting all the pieces in place, except the crucial one. And the writing sample I'll show you, you can see what I mean by that. Usually the syllabus is not, because that's not an essay. So when you write an essay, it's different. So maybe a like business report or a syllabus, it's different. So depending on the context itself or whatever you're using. So thus, he or she talked around the point, putting all the pieces in place except the crucial point one, placing the burdens of meaning on the listener, expecting him or her to figure it out. Many Arab speakers making the transition from high context to low context speech community, like American communities, face the difficulty of being direct to achieve effective interaction, and it takes them time, as it took me time to understand the idea of like how to be direct and not place so much emphasis on the flowery language. The second one is indirect and direct. The American culture leans towards direct and clear communication, accurately representing facts or expectations. It avoids emotional overtones and ambiguity and aims for precision and accuracy. The direct style of American culture is evident on many common expressions such as get to the point or say what you want. This direct verbal communication style aims for This direct verbal communication style aims for emotional neutrality, objectivity, and clarity. However, in indirect cultures such as the Arabic culture, communication is emotion-rich, striving for emotional resonance and evoking a wealth of affective responses. Arabs will rarely voice their opinions. They are likely to ignore something they disagree with, then openly reject it or criticize it. And that's like for me as an undergrad, I hardly criticize the teacher or even like voice my concern. The direct approach of communication may be perceived as rude and intrusive to Arabic speakers, while the indirect approach is likely to appear ambiguous, confusing, and even deceptive to individuals from Western cultures. Moreover, American people tend to directly link word and action, as evidenced by phrases like practice what you preach, while in Arabic cultures, words are more readily tied to emotions than to direct action. Okay. Then we have the third category is being and doing. So another dominant cultural divide between the American and Arabic culture is based on doing versus being and becoming. So while doing culture is task-oriented, being culture is based on people and relationships. So the American culture is classified as doing culture that places a premium on activity, which results in accomplishments that are measurable. Such cultures emphasize the importance of achievement and measurement of accomplishment. In contrast, the Arab culture is a being culture that places greater importance on an individual's birth, family, background, and rank over achievements and developments. Even though this sentiment has changed over time, many Arabs still take pride in their family's rank. However, this does not mean that Arabs do not value the work or achievement of their speakers or their community. They value their sense of accomplishment with a collectivist and not individualistic approach. And that takes us to the fourth category. Okay, so collectivist and individualistic. Individualism and collectivism distinction ultimately comes down to the importance placed on the individual versus the group. So the American culture falls into the primary category, while the Arab culture falls into the latter. Individualism is measured by things such as the importance of an individual, the personal investment, the personal time that the person is doing. While individualistic cultures expect members to look after themselves, collectivist cultures protect their groups for ultimate loyalty. Arabs prefer collectivism and respect hierarchy, attachment to family, and group loyalty. Their respect for their superiors is evoked in their actions. Therefore, Arab students tend to respect authority and expect teachers to decide for them. So even if you want them to choose a topic for themselves to write, they say, we do not know. You, why don't you decide for us? And I see that mostly in, freshmen, students, especially, first-year students, and you can't, you have to hold their hands, and you can choose. You have the choice to do it. Still, they want you to kind of choose for them. And because of the challenging authority thing. Then we have linear and nonlinear. The linear thought pattern is characterized by its orderliness. It follows events chronologically, varies empiricism, and stresses presentation in singular themes. It is typically found in individualistic cultures like the American culture. Zaharna 2004 finds that American Americans tend to stress beginning and ends of events, to prefer unitary themes, and to rely heavily on empirical evidence. They tend to present points in sequence and to follow organizational structures. Thus, writing follows the same pattern, logic order. However, the nonlinear culture thought pattern is characterized by several themes co-occurring at the same time. Verbal utterances are emphasized by nonverbal behavior, and people and events are prioritized over time, orientation and orderliness. The nonlinear style is typically found in collectivist cultures like the Arab culture, so Arabs move easily between ambiguity and fluid metaphors to create meaningful associations. Okay. And the last one in terms of communication, the last category is ascribed and attained. And what I mean by ascribed, ascribed status involves fixed expectations based on non-chosen traits such as family or inherited positions, while attained characteristics is based on individualistic behavior traits, skills, and accomplishments. Achieved or attained identity has become prominent in cultures in which privacy and anonymity are increasingly happening. In unascribed cultures, face is extremely important. Since Arabs take so much pride in their family name and rank, the Arab culture is considered to have an ascribed status. Titles are used extensively, not only as a sign of respect, but also to indicate status. However, the American culture is based on achieved status. People gain status based on their individual merits, such as education. Okay. So in summary, the Arab culture has features that are different from the characteristics of the American culture. Being aware of these differences can help teachers understand the intentions behind Arab students' behaviors, actions, and communication style. Such understanding will help alleviate the misunderstanding that may occur between the two parties. And to continue with the same idea, now I will go to discuss the differences in terms of the two cultural persuasion styles. So now the differences in persuasion across cultures, Arab style versus American style. Different cultures like Arab and American differ not only in communication styles but also in modes of organization and conventions of writing discourse, including the use of rhetorical features, stylistic patterns, and effective persuasion. The two cultures seem to have fundamentally different perspectives on language role and function. Understanding the role of the Arabic language can explain to us the source behind the writing choices students adopt when writing essays in English. What follows is a list of and discussion of the distinct rhetorical preferences and devices Arab writers have in contrast with American writers. Okay, so the first one is repetition versus simplicity. Okay, so the stylistic feature of repetition is highly esteemed in Arabic literary culture. Repetition is defined, quote, as multiple instances of an idea or word to attract the attention of the reader and emphasize the meaning, end quote. Arabic speakers use repetition as a persuasive tool and to create a cohesive text. Repetition, a feature that's not easily changed, exists at the very heart of the Arabic language and discourse. It occurs at the phonological, morphological, and lexical syntax and semantic levels. Zaharna, 1995, argues that, quote, repetition in Arabic is decidedly a positive feature. It's not uncommon to find a string of descriptive phrases or words or referring to one phenomena, and the writing sample I'm going to show you kind of follows the same idea. End quote. So repetition for Arabs is an ideological tool to reinforce one's thoughts, to emphasize a point, and to create an emotional resonance. However, using repetition when writing essays in English is problematic, as it can be noted as redundant and deviating away from simplicity. And I can speak to that as a student. I always was redundant, like just be direct and straight to the point. So Americans may sparingly use repetition as a rhetorical device, but overuse is seen as unnecessary, verbose, and potentially insulting to the listener. Okay. The second one is imagery versus accuracy. So while American writing leans toward accuracy, Arab speakers and writers utilize metaphors and analogies to engage the audience and hold their attentions. Arab speakers who tend to considerably use more adverbs and descriptive adjectives to emphasize a message. The frequent use of vivid metaphors aided by a descriptive adjective and adverbs may be perceived as peculiar or even outlandish by American speakers. Americans tend to employ facts and figures to illustrate and support argument. Okay. And according to Villanova, 1995, Arabic prose tends to have longer sentences than English prose, given to coordinate rather than subordinate clauses. There is a tendency to arithmetical balance. The discourse generally tends towards the global, leaning heavily on proverb-like phrases, what English would consider cliches. Okay, the Arabic culture kind of like emphasizes. So language becomes for Arab a psychological mean to connect with the audience. The magical sounds of the words, along with the images, powerfully affects its Arab audience like no other language. So to Arabs, powerful and convincing language is music to their ears. So while English writing aims for simplicity and clarity of argument, from the beginning to the end, Arabic composition relies heavily on extensive use of rhetorical figures and their repetitions. Then the third one is exaggeration versus understatement. The use of exaggeration is another language characteristic that Arabs use in their writing. While Arabs favor elaborate forms of expression, repetition, and exaggeration, Americans prefer brevity. While Arabs prefer to use overassertion, Americans tend to use understatement. Okay, so an Arab practitioner may need to tone down his or her message for an American public, while an American practitioner might need to strengthen them. While American people may find exaggeration to be boastful, people from Arabic cultures frequently use exaggeration as literary device or mere like just statements of fact. Okay. Statements which Arab perceive as firm or strong may sound exaggerated or overstated to American. Okay. And the last one is vague and indirect versus specific. Arabs' preference to use indirect and vague statements as part of their communicative style is associated with high versus low context communication styles. Since Arabs tend to use high context style of communication in which the message is implicit and embedded in the physical context, the writing deviates from the directness the American style of writing represents. So while Arabs perceive direct questions and answers as embarrassment, Americans may perceive the lack of direct statements as ambiguous, confusing, or even deceitful. So what Americans see as frank and straightforward style of writing, Arabs may see as offensive. Okay. Now, in what follows, I will read a short kind of paragraph by an Arab ESL student who is studying in the U.S., and the student was asked to write an illiteracy autobiography. I'm going to read the paragraph, and you can see it. Of course, when you write an illiteracy autobiography, you have to kind of like show the trajectory, how you learned the language, and how, okay. So I'm going to read this is the first draft that she wrote, okay. Okay. There is no doubt with every mission, there are challenges that we face. And with every idea, there are challenges, problems for life. However, in education, there is nothing impossible. Every challenge must be faced. Storms must be conquered. Being in the eye of the storm does not mean giving up. Problems do not last, especially for the believers. Problems die out, rain stops, clouds disappear, and sun shines. After night, day comes, so never stop. Challenges change us to become more mature, get stronger, and increase our faith in the importance of knowledge and success. Along with the way, there will be more challenges. Challenges assume different facades. New storms arise and different types of precipitations form. Nevertheless, we must always be ready to face the challenge, benefit from the experiences, and evaluate our learning journey for better performance and further improvement. I may not be able to control the actions others take toward me. However, I can compose my response. The pain from the turmoil or challenge will not stop me. Pain can be turned into profanity. However, I am the one who makes the decision to be tender or tough, bitter or better, and loser or gainer. There is always something to be gained. After each challenge, we get stronger. And when I met with a student and asked her, why did you write this? And she said when she grew up as a student in high school, she was not encouraged to finish her education and to pursue a college degree. Because of that, she felt like she kind of like over, she was able to overcome the challenges there, and now she's in college, she's learning. And that's why. And as you can see, most of it, there is nothing, there is no thesis, nothing that kind of directs you to what she's trying to say, and all of it just metaphors and flowery language and expressions, okay? And so this is honestly the first draft that we were able to, like, go through different drafts. But as you can see, like, from the beginning, what they want to emphasize is just the imagery, okay? So now I'm going to move to discussion, and I want to ask you, if you had this kind of student, what would you do? If you had this in your writing classroom, okay.
I don't have an answer to that question, but something that really strikes me is professors can work with a student to get them to maybe be more straightforward. Mm-hmm. But if a student were writing this for a college essay to get into grad school, mm-hmm. or something, they would be at a real disadvantage. Somebody that wouldn't know the student would look at this and say, this is not appropriate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, like, yeah, my question, how would you help the student move from the indirect to the direct approach and be kind of like concise and straight to the point? What kind of feedback would you give them?
Yeah, see, I would probably feed right into what Americans do. I'd have to say, so what is it that you really want to say?
Yes, okay.
And enjoy it. But I'm not sure that's the most helpful thing to ask.
Yeah, okay.
I was just going to say the same thing, that question that you asked, mm-hmm. I think is the best question. Why did you write this? Mm-hmm. And then when you got her answer, maybe try and direct her down the path.
Yes. And honestly, what made it even easier for me to work with her is not to focus on the whole journey, just your language journey. How did you learn the language here? So instead of focusing on the whole education journey, just focus on the language learning itself. And we were able to go through different steps. And of course, it's going to take time because you cannot address this issue in class. You have to wait with the student outside of class. And usually students listen and they come to office hours. You can work with them. Do you have any other suggestion or any? I have more scenarios to discuss, but I mean, I was. Okay, I'm gonna move to the next scenario. Okay, in this one, let me see if. Okay, I'm gonna read from here.
So your typical pattern in class is to begin with about 50 minutes of lecturing and then have students discuss and reflect on concepts you have introduced. This is a whole class discussion with your class of about 25 students. You offer credit for participation, but several weeks into the class, you realize there are several students who have never participated in the class discussion. What would you do to engage them, to make them part of the discussion, to invite them? What are some strategies that you would make? And especially now, I want to raise awareness about of course, you have now online classes and the online portion, because I also utilize that in terms of motivating students to discuss or to raise any issues that they have. So what would you do in this kind of situation?
First thing I would do is divide into smaller groups.
Okay, yes. Okay. Do you usually teach classes that are all international students, or you have a mix? I'm sorry?
Mix.
Okay. And do you have a strategy for dividing the students? I'm asking this because when I started teaching about 10 years ago, I would never allow the students who come from the same group, who speak the same language, to be in the same, because thinking they will not communicate. But after doing some research and even through some classroom strategies, I found that some of the ones who understand the content may help the others. So it's kind of facilitate the learning. So I kind of now do both. So even if they speak the same language and they converse in their own language, I found it to be beneficial. So even though I do not understand what's going on, but I feel like they are communicating, collaborating to make sure that all the students understand the content. Okay. So what else would you do?
I'll do something starting early on that's low stakes, mm-hmm. participation.
Yes.
So I'll just say that's the main topic for your paper. I want to meet with everybody.
Okay.
We'll just go around.
Yes.
The room and everybody has to say, mm-hmm. something, even the,
yes.
quiet ones. And then it doesn't always move into the final way they get used to talking, but
yeah.
sometimes.
Sometimes. What I use even in some of the strategies I use myself, we have the online discussion forum. So I create a weekly discussion board threads, and I find that students who are quiet in class thrive in that environment. And what I do, I read the comments before I come to class, take some of these comments, have them on the projector, discuss these comments, so you can see that the students' face kind of light up, and they start to participate. Of course, it's not easy for them to participate because of the language barrier, but you can see that the progress they make. And of course, you're not going to be able to make everyone participate in the discussion. At least you can help those who want to be helped or are reluctant to be helped, but still they can make sense at the end of the class. Any other suggestions? Yes, yes, and that's why before ending class time, I urge them if they have any issue or they don't understand, they can come to to see me during office hours, or they can communicate with each other, but you cannot control what goes outside the class. And sometimes you have students emailing you, asking you for more clarification, and in that situation, I invite them to come and work with me one-on-one.
Would you ever give lecture notes?
I do. Yes, yes. And also, look, the way I organize it, I have it on what we call LMS, it's like Canvas. We organize all of our material bi-weekly. So this is the lesson for this week. The PowerPoint, the discussion, everything is there so they can go back and read. And if they have any question, they can contact me. Yes. Okay. Let's move to the next scenario. And I've seen this because we teach rhetorical analysis essays, and the way I do in my class, instead of just analyzing a text, we can choose a video, controversial video, analyze it, then I ask them to create a video on their own. But sometimes you feel like the videos are kind of like reproduction of the video itself. So what I did to make sure that they understand is I go over the script with them before they make their own video. And I want to make sure that they understand the analysis behind the assignment before they make the video. So if you have something like this in your own classes, what would you do? How would you approach it? Or if you have a student coming to the writing center, because most of us faculty members or teachers would send our students, go to the writing centers, they would be able to deal with you, and that's usually not the case. How would you deal with them? What would you do? Any idea? When I worked in the writing center, I would watch the video with them or read the text, try to highlight certain themes, try to highlight, this is maybe what the teacher is looking for. Of course, I'm not doing the assignment for them, but kind of like doing an outline, finding the main themes, and help them write their own script or even their own rhetorical analysis. Anybody else has any idea? I'm sure you guys have more experience than I do. Yes. 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 Yeah. You're not making us an assumption, but maybe you're not. And you're not accusing them, but you're kind of raising the issue and see if they interact with you. Yeah. And I see this is one way for them because they will live in this country for a few years before going back. So they need kind of to understand the politics in this country. So this is one way for them to understand what's going on. Because what I ask them to analyze is kind of controversial issues that they need. So it's one way, even though the class focuses on writing, it's also a way for them to understand the American culture or the American context. Okay?
I think this is a really interesting question. And the kinds of classes that I teach, taking critical positions on policies
yes.
or understandings of a situation, I try to normalize that. I try to make that normal in the classroom so that they get in that habit of what do you agree with, what do you disagree with. And one of the ways that I think I try to do that is by bringing it back to their own stories.
Okay.
So how have you experienced, maybe in your context, in your relationships, a different understanding of this policy?
Yes.
And then really invite them to bring their story.
Nice. And have you found students who are not American joining the conversation, expressing their views?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah. Whether it's telling stories from back home
yes.
or from here in the United States.
Yes.
If they've been here for a while.
Yeah. And honestly, I found it like very kind of eye-opening, and like it's a time for them to grow and see, like understand what's going on around them. Okay. The next scenario, which you might find interesting, is you frequently put students together in groups to work on projects. One of your male students has identified himself as a Muslim from an Arab country. When you pair him with a female student for peer review, he requests a different problem, noting that he does not feel comfortable working in a pair with a female student. And I had this in one of my classes. So what would you do in this kind of situation? Do you honor his request? I'll let you know what I did. But would you honor his request?
It was happening like in class. Like in the class, I was saying you're with this person. You're with
yes,
this person.
Because I yeah.
I would pretend like it's not a big deal at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I would give him another partner.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would have a conversation with
yes.
him after class.
Yes. Okay, and that's what I did the first time. But when he came to me the second time and he told me, I may not feel, I said, I can't. So you have to get you, and honestly, he has to get used to the idea of like communicating with other students, with other genders, and that's how the environment here is. If you do not like it, that's your issue. And he cannot even proceed forward, honestly, with this. Anybody else?
Did he agree to that the third time?
He had to, because the grades are in jeopardy, maybe, but he agreed to, yeah. Okay, and one time, like I do not have this scenario, I had a student who wrote all of his essay in Arabic, and he wanted to translate it to English. So if you had this type of student, what would you do?
The student always wants to write in Arabic?
Yes, then translate the essay to English, which was... I'm sorry?
I tell my students they can do that.
They can do that?
Write in their first language first
mm-hmm.
and translate it. There are sometimes translation issues.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Students who are in the early days of being here.
Yes. But did you find that when they write in their own language, do they adhere to the American style of writing?
Well, that's the hard part.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what I did maybe for the first draft or for the first assignment, I allowed him to do it because it's kind of brainstorming session. But as we moved, he has to think in English in order to kind of like give a concrete essay. So that's what, okay. Anybody has any?
I've worked with a number of nursing students who many times there are multiple choice tests.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, it was kind of easier for me because he spoke Arabic. So I understand Arabic. So I was able to read the first draft, but I don't think I'll be able to do it if he wrote in another language besides Arabic or English. So that's why I say, as brainstorming, like tool, yes, but if you want to move to the first draft, it has to be in English, at least to know if it makes sense to me or if I want to give you feedback, yeah. And one thing is like writing center, tutors in UMD, University of Maryland, some of them speak different languages and they are willing to help the students in that first language. So in that case, I would send them there. But other than that, I don't think I'll be able to help them. Okay. You had something to say? That's why I said, look, as the early stages, yes. But as they move on, they have to learn and to think in English. And once they start seeing the logic behind it in English, it would make more sense for them, yes. But as a brainstorming session, it would work. And sometimes, even though I have been here for a long time, sometimes I write some of my main ideas in Arabic because the two languages are still in conversation in your mind, and it would make more sense for them. This is what I have. If you have guys any question or any comment.
Just a question. I think going back to some of those other scenarios.
Yes.
A number of the ones that you laid out to me seem less like scenarios for English as a second language or Arab American students than just students who aren't that ready for college, right? Or just
these are students who are like college students. And these scenarios, yes.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is that I wonder if there's some way to distinguish between what are the struggles that Arab American students have or ESL students have, mm-hmm. and how are those different than students who are native English speakers but aren't sort of, they just haven't done a lot of writing before. So, for example, like the other scenarios where you have like the deference to authority or submission mm-hmm. to authority.
Yes.
So this happens a lot in my classes with native English speakers.
Even with native English speakers?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if I ask them, like, I want you to write a paper and make an argument, they will listen and they will nod and mm-hmm. they will give me a paper that just has lots of information but no argument.
Okay. But do you think that's not because they do not want to question the authority or because they do not know how to write an argument? I think that's the difference.
That's a good
question. Yeah. Because I also teach native speakers, and honestly, it's just information, informative. It doesn't have an argument. And I think part of it is they do not know how to do the analysis. They do not know how to write in like the argumentative way. It's not just the questioning of authority. But for other students, especially Arabs, the questioning is kind of like what hinders them from creating an effective argument.
I find that grammar, my international students are better at grammar than native English speakers. They may not, there may be some word choices that are unusual for an English speaker. Prepositions may be
yes.
articles, but actual grammatical errors don't occur as much as with native speakers.
I feel like even like it applies to me. When I came here, I knew all the grammar rules. So I scored perfect when it comes to grammar. But when you have grammar in context, sentences, connected sentences together, that became difficult.
Why do you think that I was interested in what you said a while about students writing more in coordinated sentences rather than subordination? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a rhetorical choice also.
Yes. Because that's the way we were taught in Arabic language. The ideas are more connected in correlation than in subordination. So that's part of the Arabic context. You had a question. I'm sorry. I don't feel it's... Yes. And of course it depends on, like, this is kind of like individual choice. For me, I always try to find the balance between the two cultures And like, I want to still be proficient in Arabic and also be proficient in English. And I try to maintain that balance as much as possible. And also I have my children who were born here, raised here, and I try to maintain this sense. But sometimes those who were born here, you find one language is kind of overcoming the other. And it usually it's English because this is what they learned in school. But I always strive to have that balance between both languages. And that's a strength. It's not, limitation.
Move.
Yes.
Have them be more individualistic and speak in the eye.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the audience, like when you know who the audience is, sometimes I feel like when I am in school, I am more active, I am more kind of like confident expressing myself. And when I have like Arab speakers, Arab relatives are kind of like low tone. Kind of so you kind of have to, moves, like different moves according to the context,
Well, it is 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And I think we need to keep on our schedule because there's some...
Yes, I'm sorry, I wanted to show you the website.
Oh, yes. This is the website I was talking about earlier, and you're not quite finished updating it, right?
I have.
But when she gets it finished, then we'll have
to... I'll send you the name. I can't see from here, that's why I'm using the laptop, sorry.
So the language is on the right side.
And also if you want to adopt this book, there's a book here. You can use it for your training. It's so good. You use most of the material from that book.
Okay.
I did some interviews and some data collection, but also the work comes from that book. And it has like even more languages and more kind of distinctions.
When you send that link home.
Yes.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.